Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Thousands of women in our area are victims of domestic violence and sexual abuse every year. As troubling as that is, many thousands more do not report attacks. Congress is now considering new legislation to combat the problem of abuse on campus. The National Football League has begun to tackle the domestic violence problem after some negative publicity about how it disciplines players who take their violent acts home with them. I'm Don Marsh. We'll be talking about the problems, dealing with them, and solutions on today's program. Joining me in studio, Susan Kidder is Executive Director of Safe Connections. It offers services for women and teen girls who have experienced domestic violence, sexual assault, and childhood sexual abuse. Cindy Malott is Crisis Intervention Coordinator and heads SART, the Sexual Assault Response Team, part of the YWCA's Regional Sexual Assault Center. She works with law enforcement, prosecutors, and victim service agencies. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Let me try to get an overview of what's going on here locally, if I may. Susan, I'll start with you. In the area of domestic violence, what kind of a profile do we have here?
Well, actually, Safe Connections, and our work is to prevent and end domestic and sexual violence, and we do that through three principal areas: our crisis intervention services with our 24-hour crisis helpline, therapy and support groups for women, teen girls, and teen boys who are victims, and prevention education, working with our middle school, high school, and college kids. One national statistic that really kind of relates to Missouri is that Missouri ranks 16th in the nation for calls to the National Domestic Helpline, and 31% of those calls are from St. Louis. So it is a huge issue in St. Louis, and although we're working to address that and remedy that, more resources, more time, more effort needs to be placed in that area.
Is this the problem that is growing or remaining fairly static?
That's a difficult question to ask, because as more awareness is brought to it, there may be an increase in the women or teens who bring forth or come forth having experienced that issue. So it's a difficult question to know whether there is more or whether just more people are reporting it.
Yeah, and the reporting is an issue, as I indicated. A lot of these crimes go unreported.
You are so correct.
Yeah. Right. Cindy Malott, let me get your perspective on that.
Well, and actually, I agree with Susan. One of the things, if we see higher numbers of reports, that's not necessarily, particularly when I'm speaking in regard to sexual assault, that doesn't necessarily indicate that there's a higher number of rapes or sexual assaults occurring. It, in a lot of cases, simply means that there's better systems in place to respond to those reports, and people feel safer, in generally speaking, coming forward in a lot of different ways. Personally, and also feeling that the more potential accountability for offenders.
Is there any way to connect the dots between these two crimes, between domestic violence and sexual assault?
Well, I think there's a lot of interconnection between the two. Not in every single case, but definitely. I think that there's a lot of victims of sexual assault we work with. It's not uncommon for the perpetrator to be a significant other.
Right. Same, obviously, with domestic violence. Yeah, what I'm kind of looking at is there a typically abused or assaulted person and a typical abuser?
Cindy
and I are both kind of shaking our heads. I mean, yeah. I don't know that we can profile or define what's typical. One of the few data points or statistics that we collect on our 24-hour crisis helpline is zip code. And what we know is that it doesn't matter what you drive, what you do for a living, how many kids you have, what neighborhood you live in. We receive calls from every single zip code in the entire St. Louis metropolitan area. So abuse is happening no matter where one lives, where one works, what one has in the bank.
But I go ahead, Cindy.
Well, again, one of the services we provide at the YWCA, we have, and also three program areas. We have education and outreach, clinical services, counseling and therapy services, and then we also have crisis intervention, and that's the area that I supervise. And one of the things that we do through our crisis intervention program is provide a 24-hour in-person response to victims of rape and sexual assault at hospital emergency rooms throughout St. Louis City and County. We work with all adult hospitals in St. Louis City and County, responding to victims of rape and sexual assault. Every year, generally speaking, we see at least 400, usually over 400 people a year in the local hospitals presenting at the ER. And I can tell you, in connection to what Susan just said, we're talking about people from all different walks of life and all different backgrounds. We know statistics, certain ages are more likely to be at certain points in people's lives, depending on their age, that might be put a risk factor for them. But generally speaking, it's across the board from every different area, St. Louis and the city and county.
Are there any prevalent myths with regard to what we're talking about today? For instance, I've heard that most of the times when a man abuses someone, he has been abused himself as a youngster, that sort of thing.
Well, there, whether that's a myth or not, we know, I mean, data shows us that those who grow up in an environment where abuse becomes the norm, the abuser is four times more likely, or the child is four times more likely to become an abuser as an adult. So there is some correlation there. I think maybe one of the myths might be that and I'll talk mostly in women language or she pronouns
by all means.
And that's because 85% of the time it's women who are the
sure.
victims and not always the survivors of violence from men. Questioning the woman, things like why doesn't she leave? You know, why does she keep returning? That kind of victim blaming is something that is not helpful, is not productive, and is not really the accurate question. The accurate question is, why doesn't he stop being abusive?
But the fact does remain that women often do stay.
Yeah, for you're correct, and for very, very lots of reasons. Notwithstanding, again, the question of why doesn't he stop being abusive, she may stay for lots of reasons. It may be financial. It may be with children. There may be a faith-based reason for that. She may be very fearful and concerned that she's even going to be believed that she is a victim or survivor of domestic violence.
And for a lot of victims, I think it's easy, generally speaking, for us as a culture to say, or for an average person that maybe hasn't at least knowingly had someone close to them go through this, well, you know, it's ridiculous. Why would she stay? Who would stay in a situation like that? But sometimes if you can take a few seconds and put yourself in that person's position, sometimes for a lot of women that are in an abusive situation, you're talking about the only alternative for them or what they see as an option is to potentially go to a strange place, a shelter that maybe is somewhere they're not at all comfortable with, don't know anyone there, separated from what little support system they do have because of the, obviously, they need to keep the shelter a secret. And we have some fantastic shelters here in St. Louis, and they do a fabulous job, but it's still a very frightening prospect, taking their children out of school, possibly not being able to get back and forth to work, or if they want to be safe, because the perpetrator would know where how to find them and track them back. So it's when you kind of take a minute and really think of the whole perspective from the victim's point of view, it's really a lot easier to realize why it's not an easy thing to leave a situation like that. It's very understandable why it takes often several different times of the person trying to leave. And we also know statistically the most dangerous time for that woman that's leaving that relationship, a domestic violence relationship, is when she tries to leave.
Or after she has left. Again, this is mm-hmm. another thing that I've heard over the years, that is a very dangerous time. And frequently, not only are they assaulted, they're often murdered.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because it's important to understand that domestic violence is a pattern. It's a pattern of coercion and a pattern of control. And it comes in many forms. It can be physical, which is probably the most readily known to the general public, but also verbal, emotional, sexual abuse, and also now technological abuse, where there's GPS tracking, there's Facebook and all sorts of social media mm-hmm. abuse possible.
Stalking intertwined with when the woman does try to leave or start over again somewhere else.
Right. You know, I asked about myths a short time ago. Another of the things that I have heard, and I have no way of knowing if it's true or not, is that certain women seem to be attracted to men who will abuse them.
I have never experienced, I've been doing this for over 20-something, I don't even want to think about how many years at this point, but over 20 years, I wouldn't definitely say that that's a myth. I think sometimes people are vulnerable. Again, when you look at the different options that are often available to people who are in these relationships, it's not an easy choice. It's not an easy decision. And when you start to remove resources from people, the more resources you have, sometimes at least you have some options that people with less resources would have, as far as perhaps if you had resources, you might be able to relocate somewhere. Even then, it's limited what your options are. But if you take someone who has no resources or very limited resources, and their only income is a job, they're now going to have to leave if they go to the shelter and remove their children and have no financial resources, support, place to stay. It's not an easy decision. I don't know that they're attracted to that person, but they're potentially vulnerable to that person for maybe those reasons.
Who is most vulnerable? Is there, again, I'll look for a profile if there is one. Is there a type of woman who is more vulnerable than another?
If you're talking about sexual assault, we do know that college-age women are at one of the highest risk age areas. The bulk of the victims that we see really range at all different ages, and we work with at our agency 14 and older. But I would say, so we know that the college age is definitely a high risk for sexual assault. Older adolescents to really young adults are the highest percentage of victims that we see. And again, we know we don't see all victims in St. Louis, but that is consistent, but definitely not. We clearly see all different age ranges for sexual assault, from elderly people to younger adolescent victims.
In the age group you just identified, why would they be more vulnerable?
For a lot of different reasons. Particularly if we're going to talk about college age students, there's a lot of predators on campuses. And sometimes they're in a situation where you've got a lot of young people who are going from potentially more of a structured environment into a college living situation, maybe in dorms, and it doesn't necessarily have to be, so I don't want to stereotype that also, but you have, generally speaking, young people coming in, and oftentimes they have a false sense of safety. They're surrounded by groups of people that they've just met, and in their minds, sometimes they, and this is something we hear fairly consistently from victims who have been sexually assaulted, who are college age, is they really felt like they were with a group of people who they felt safe with, almost compared it to the group they went to high school with, that they were always safe with that group in their mind, so they thought they'd have the same protection in this group. So it's very difficult. Oftentimes they're in situations where they have a false sense of security. They're exposed to potentially people they don't know, and they feel like they know them better than they do. And then we have the whole conversation about university response to sexual assault and the implications of that and how that can affect victims, whether they come forward or not to even report.
And there are other factors as well. There's drinking sometimes is involved in this. Drugs can sometimes be involved.
Absolutely. We know the number one, when we talk about drug-facilitated sexual assault, or generally we think of all kinds of different drugs that are used, but we know the number one thing that's used to facilitate a sexual assault is alcohol. So you have young people who are also going out, sometimes drinking more than they've drank had before, and they're at parties and there are things like this, and sometimes they're very vulnerable. And it's difficult because it's important for us to realize young people are going to make bad decisions, sometimes bad decisions, and drink underage. But sometimes the victims will take that as a reason that it was okay for them to be raped and sexually assaulted. And absolutely not. It really just made them more vulnerable to a perpetrator.
From the domestic violence perspective, anything to add to that vulnerability issue?
Well, I'd like to kind of add to the sexual violence on campus. Safe Connections started our Safe Connections on Campus programming about 3 or 4 years ago, to working to address this issue. And while there are, quote, predators on campuses, really our approach is around consent and involving principally boys, emerging men, in leadership development, bystander intervention, to help create a culture of consent on college campuses, so that principally young men can and do ask for consent, because sexual contact without consent is rape. So our approach is educating college students around the issue and the need for consent.
I want to pick up on some of those points, but I have to take a break. We'll do that now. We are talking about issues of domestic violence and sexual abuse, pardon me, with Susan Kidder, Executive Director of Safe Connections, and Cindy Malott, who is a Crisis Intervention Coordinator for the YWCA. Back to continue this conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to take your questions or comments with regard to these issues. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send us a tweet, do so at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on domestic violence and sexual abuse in just a moment. Our guests in studio, Susan Kidder, Executive Director of Safe Connections, and Cindy Malott, Crisis Intervention Coordinator with the YWCA. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder will hold a press conference this afternoon. It's to announce that the Justice Department plans to open a wide-ranging civil rights investigation into the practices of the Ferguson Police Department. This, of course, following the shooting last month of Michael Brown. And the Missouri Department of Transportation plans to shut down a section of eastbound I-64 in St. Louis this weekend for road work. The project will impact motorists heading to Lou Fest in Forest Park and the St. Louis Rams home opener at the Edward Jones Dome. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Susan Kidder and Cindy Malott. Susan, let me pick up with you. You alluded to this a moment ago with regard to what colleges are doing. Are colleges doing enough to deal with this this problem, and on what levels?
Yeah, to this point, I think probably the best answer, the most candid answer, is no. There now, fortunately, is broader and greater awareness being brought, and the light is being shined on our college communities, with the expectation that, again, they focus on this, they report this, they create an environment that supports and is safe for women or men who are raped on campus to come forward and report. Mm-hmm. And know that there's going to be, that it's going to be taken seriously. And there's going to be some kind of investigation, support, that it's not going to be dismissed or thrown under the rug.
I think it really, what stands out to me when I think about the issue itself is accountability. I think a lot of our colleges and universities locally are starting to look at the issue and starting to really try to improve their response to victims of sexual assault on campus. But accountability, I really think, is the really important thing, and that's several different key areas of accountability I think are important. One of which would be transparency. When we're working with sexual assault victims who are on college campuses, one of the things they report to us is really being not given accurate, or even if it's unintentional, clear information about what the reporting process on the campus is. What does that look like? Is there someone they can talk to that they can have confidentiality and talk with that person? A lot of times, some campuses, the staff are mandated to report, or there isn't a key person to report to. Some victims have actually been confused as to whether they were reporting to campus security, or some campuses have an actual police department, or if they're reporting to the local law enforcement jurisdiction. I've talked to victims who are coming in making reports with law enforcement, which is how I get connected with them, who actually thought they had made a report when they talked to campus security months earlier. So that transparency, that accountability, and then also having a program in place to respond at the universities to victims coming forward. For example, oftentimes student review boards and other things are in place to review these cases where there's no trained investigator, there's no one that's trauma-informed, meaning that some of the questions and the things that the victims put through, oftentimes in front of other students, mm-hmm. other staff, are just horrific. Some of the descriptions of the questions they're asked, and incredibly graphic and unnecessary, and would never be something that would even take place. And I've done this for a long time and work really closely with law enforcement and with the court process. These things would never take place. These type of questions would never even be put to a victim this way. In some of the most difficult cases that I've seen reported to our local law enforcement, but these student groups who have basically no training oftentimes can really re-traumatize sexual assault victims, and we hear that repeatedly.
I'm also under the impression that colleges and even high schools could do a better job of working with parents so that parents can talk to their kids before going off to campus about some of the dangers, and these are dangers that we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. One of our programs is our teen dating violence prevention programming, which is in middle schools and high schools. And it's really alarming that research shows that over 80% of parents don't know that teen dating violence is even an issue. So getting to our parents, and you're exactly right, and helping them understand that, yes, indeed, it is an issue, and that one out of four of our high school girls is the victim of sexual or physical abuse in her high school career, one. And then, two, working from a prevention angle on college campuses. And we do that with all of the local and some regional colleges because they do have an interest in knowing how to do this, knowing how to be transparent, knowing how to support those students who are reporting, and what steps to take to really create this culture, this campus culture that does not support or tolerate violence.
I have more questions on this particular issue, but I want to bring a caller in. Aaron is joining us from St. Louis. I think his comments may be appropriate at this time. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, I just wanted to say my earliest memories are of being moved around women's safe houses because my mother was a victim of domestic violence. And as an adult, as I entered my first relationship, I found myself being a victim of domestic violence and not knowing how to have an appropriate relationship. So as I work with men, I myself am in a gay relationship, but that doesn't change the fact that if you grew up in a home where domestic violence was prevalent, that you're more prone to be a victim or a victimizer. Thank you.
Aaron, thanks so much for the call. Either of you like to respond to Aaron's?
Well, in regard to, and this is something we didn't talk about earlier, in regard to sexual abuse, that is something that we have definitely seen as instances. It's not been entirely uncommon for us to see generational sexual abuse take place, where it's almost something that family pressure on victims is to be silent. Don't embarrass the family. Don't embarrass our culture. We don't talk with, in some cases where maybe there hasn't been a good relationship with law enforcement. If you involve law enforcement, this is going to be something that will be, your children will be taken away from you because you still know this family member or you've stayed with that family member. Again, you see with people with limited resources, there's additional, it exacerbates all of that. But definitely there is a connection. Oftentimes, I'm not saying obviously in every case scenario by any means, but there's definitely some connections with, particularly I've seen this with generational sexual abuse that's just prevalent throughout families.
That's kind of what I was getting at before with regard to this generational aspect of it. Back to, I just want to get back to the college thing for a moment because I wanted to ask you, and I'll put it to you, Susan, first, with regard to Senator McCaskill and what she's doing on Capitol Hill. What do you see in what she is proposing do you think that would be most helpful?
Well, in what she's proposing really, I mean, Cindy actually outlined most of the points in the Bipartisan Campus Accountability and Safety Act, which really would establish five areas, requirements for colleges and universities to adhere to establish the kind of a campus support center services for students, to offer transparency in terms of the relationship between universities and law enforcement, whatever jurisdictions there are in those communities. Also, they would be required to perform an annual student survey of students' sexual violence experience on those campuses, and training is a big component in this bill as well. So we would support those provisions because what they do is they do require, but they also assist our colleges and universities to get on board with this and to seek out resources to help them do that.
Well, and another an important aspect also is, again, I believe that there it enters that prospect of accountability. Right now, the way things stand, I think that there is accountability in myth, not necessarily in practice, because the penalties are to such an extreme that it would be almost impossible to without devastating universities and affecting students as well as faculty and staff to implement basically accountability, where it does seem, and most of the things that are outlined in the bill, I think, are things that we as an agency would encourage colleges and universities to enact.
You know, realistically, I wonder if these are problems that can be legislated.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we have so little faith in our legislators anymore, it seems. I wonder if they're offering a solution to the problem.
I think as a culture we have to look at, there's a needs to be, again, speaking on accountability in a lot of different areas. Mm-hmm. I think legislatively, culturally, individually, as individual people, I think there's a lot of different areas where it's not something that can be solved with just one thing. It's something that really has to come into play. It has to come into play with what services are available, community services in our society, cultural norms and standards and myths that are basically debunked, and education is very, very important. One of the things that I think are really important that was outlined in Senator McCaskill's bill was the importance of connecting all sexual assault victims with community sexual assault center, which I think is extremely important, because then they also have, if every single victim was connected, they would have an individual advocate that could help them to understand what their options were. An advocate's job is never to say this is what you need to do, but to make sure that these young people, in a lot of cases they are young people, have the information they need at least to make a decision about how they want to go forward and to understand the process and what the options are.
Susan Kidder, how important is what's been going on with the National Football League to this whole discussion? Because there's been a lot of publicity. We initially know that some high-profile players were accused of domestic violence and got a slap on the wrist for that. Now the NFL has kind of tightened up on that, apparently, a longer suspension of play. It's gotten a lot of publicity. Is this helpful to the overall cause, this publicity?
Publicity, bringing awareness to the issue of domestic violence, sexual violence, can't be anything but positive. Bringing it into the forefront, putting a spotlight on it is very, very helpful. Now, will there be kind of issues and questions along the way in terms of how it's implemented? Well, definitely. But I think the thing to focus on and not be distracted from is that the NFL, other large organizations do, whether they like it or not, have lots of influence. And they, in this particular case, they influence not only young women, young girls, but young men and men. Because while we know that all men absolutely are not abusers, clearly, the vast majority of men are not. We know that there are men. And so we need the vast majority of men who are not abusers, who are not violent, to be role models, leaders of their peers, so we begin to have this culture of respect for women and girls. This anti-violence culture is really key.
Go ahead,
Cindy. Well, and I think seeing the NFL demonstrate what really I think is culturally our norm as a society. St. Louis is, most of the men in St. Louis are fathers, grandfathers, husbands, brothers, boyfriends. They're not perpetrators. They don't accept that behavior. And I think to see that also demonstrated in the response from the NFL to these obviously very influential athletes is extremely important.
You know, it seems there are a lot of cases like this within the NFL in particular. I hope I'm not going overboard on this, but it does seem there are a lot of cases. And I wonder if, because it's a violent sport, if it's difficult to leave that violence between the lines, as they say, and not take it home with you. You have any thoughts about that?
I think that would be an excuse. We see a lot of people, law enforcement, have to sometimes deal with violent situations. A lot of different people that do a lot of different things as their form of employment have to deal with intense stress and intense situations. It's not an excuse to bring that home. It's not an excuse to be an abuser. It's not an excuse to take that out on violating someone else.
Susan, feel the same way?
Yes. And then to again remember that domestic violence is a pattern. It's a pattern of coercion and control and abuse. And it's made through an active decision. The abuser going through a grocery store line does not abuse the clerk. The abuser in a work situation doesn't abuse his colleague. the abuser in this intimate partner relationship actively chooses to be abusive in any of those ways, you know, financially, verbally, physically. So I think that's one of the things to, again, not for the for us not to be distracted by the profession necessarily, but really, what is domestic violence?
It's tempting to generalize in situations like this, and that's a mistake, is what I'm hearing you say. Again, I want to encourage callers to come into the conversation. 382-8255 is the number. We have Barbara waiting to get on. Barbara, come on in. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was, I went to a lot of group meetings and was helped a great deal over 2 years by Safe Connections. I would recommend that as a place for anyone to go who suffers from abuse in their own home. I was financially and verbally and psychologically abused for 40 years in a long marriage. And what I learned at Safe Connections was I didn't deserve it, and I could take care of myself. But I was so sick and in a wheelchair and all kinds of things I relied on in my own home. So they really helped me figure out finances at Safe Connections and helped me to be strong enough to get an order of protection against my husband, so he had to leave the home. And I was able to stay here and be safe. And I just want to tell people to leave an abusive situation often turns into a disaster, and loss of everything and everyone you know and everything you have in your home. For me, it was medications and mobility and wheelchairs and my dog. I couldn't just leave all of that. The order of protection is what helped me to stay free and continue to get therapy for the entire year.
Well, Barbara, we're so glad that you got the help that you wanted and needed, and Susan Kidder here is very happy to hear you talk about Safe Connections the way you have.
Well, absolutely, and my hope also is that you have inspired other people to contact Safe Connections, the YWCA, other organizations that can provide help and service.
We'll put some links to various organizations, including yours, on our website, stlpublicradio.org. Cindy?
I think one of the things that really stand out when Barbara calls that we haven't talked about when you talked about at-risk individuals is the risk for people with disabilities and sexual violence and domestic violence and abuse. Yeah. It's astronomically high compared to the general population. And we see this played out with domestic sex trafficking, sexual assault, sexual violence. One of the programs we have in place in the Y is sexual health and disability education. And I know that Safe Connections also does work in that area. It has has an important focus on people with disabilities. We've had a lot of conversations, but the SHADE program is really focused to provide education and healthy relationships, education about healthy relationships, but also prevent sexual violence and abuse with people with disabilities. It's extremely important.
We'll get the information, as I say, on these sites and where this information and organizations are available on our website. I have to take another break. We'll do that now, come back and continue our conversation with Susan Kidder and Cindy Malott in just a moment. We're talking about domestic violence and sexual abuse, and we'd like to hear from you at 382-8255. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about domestic violence and sexual abuse. My guests in studio are Susan Kidder, Executive Director of Safe Connections, and Cindy Malott, Crisis Intervention Coordinator with the YWCA. Our last caller said two things I'd like to get your response to. Number one, she said she learned at Safe Connections, Susan, that I didn't deserve this. And again, with what little I know about it, this is a big problem, that women are beaten down to the point where they feel at some point they do deserve it, and they have to get over that.
That can be true. And I believe firmly that the strongest person, the strongest woman, or if it's a man in an abusive situation, the strongest person in the world, if you are on a daily, constant, hourly basis told that you are no good, no one else will love you, you are worthless, I mean, all of those very negative kinds of comments. Or if you are the victim and hopefully the survivor of physical abuse or the other kinds of abuse, you begin to wonder. Yeah. And you begin to question yourself and your worth. And that's the strongest person on the face of the earth, I believe, would begin to feel that way.
And that's your challenge when they come to you, is to get them beyond that.
Clearly. Yeah. And so that they, you know, to get them to understand the dynamics of that relationship, their role as not being the cause of that, not being the one who is perpetuating it, but to allow them to kind of reclaim their souls, to reclaim their sense of self is a big part of our work. And we do that in a way that where they make decisions for themselves. We don't say, this is what you should do, this is what you need to do, this is what you ought to do. It's through this very guided therapy and very intentional for us to empower the women, teen girls, and teen boys to make their own choices based on where they are.
Right. Cindy?
Again, with sexual assault and sexual abuse, self-blame is definitely the number one thing that we have to work through and really battle as advocates. You will see self-blame from sexual assault victims. Everyone from the young college student who was really intoxicated and blames themselves for drinking or for not controlling the situation more, not realizing that even though they made a decision that wasn't great, they didn't deserve to be raped or sexually assaulted. You also see that with a person, a victim in their own home who survived a rape or sexual assault, where general society would put no culpability on them. You'll see that same level of self-blame. And it's just something that is very, very consistent with sexual assault victims across the board.
Our caller also made another reference, and that was to psychological abuse. We tend to think of this in terms of somebody hitting somebody else, but actually psychological abuse can be just as damaging, can it not?
Clearly. A bone will heal.
Yeah.
A black eye will heal. But that the breaking of one's spirit and soul takes sometimes a longer time to heal, mm-hmm. and can be just, like you said, as devastating.
One of the things we do with our collaboration with law enforcement with St. Louis City is they will contact us directly anytime they have a victim of child sexual abuse, any type of sexual violence, but particularly in reference to child sexual abuse victims that we see with law enforcement. So I'll meet with the victim when they come in to report a past instance of child sexual abuse, whether this is an adult or an adolescent reporting abuse that happened earlier. And when you talk about psychological manipulation and really coercion and really horrific abuse, I think with sexual abuse victims, one of the things that a lot of child sexual abuse victims don't realize is most child molesters do not use physical force and violence. They use manipulation and coercion and sometimes intimidation. But a lot of victims of child sexual abuse don't realize this. So they really sometimes are shocked when I'm talking with them and explaining that this is not. Pedophiles who perpetrate child sexual abuse generally are not using physical force. They're using psychological manipulation and coercion. But as that person matures into an adult or an adolescent, often they see that as something they did, something they need to be ashamed of, something they let happen. They'll tell me, no, you don't understand. It wasn't as bad as what happened to someone else because mm-hmm. I wasn't physically held down or forced. Well, you know, you were 7 years old. You were 14
sure.
years old. You did what someone that was in an authority position told you to do.
Right. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Randy calling from Bridgeton. Randy, go ahead, please.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, one of the things, and I came into the conversation pretty late, but one of the things that I hoped you guys had discussed was in reference to the Violence Against Women Act, when in reference to housing, public housing. I've been in public housing and apartment management industry for over 15 years, and currently I'm a trainer. And one of the things that I found out is that a lot of management companies that manage public housing don't understand that there are some certain protections that's given to victims of violence that was enacted in the Violence Against Women Act that came out in 2005, and also that was broadened to include a lot of more affordable housing industry programs in 2013. And one thing that's important to note is that previously, in a lot of cases, when there was instances of violence in the household that endangered, you know, some of the surrounding units or tenants, typically the property management company would kick out the whole family, no matter if it included the victim or the perpetrator. But with the Violence Against Women Act, it gave some protection where it enabled properties or management companies, if the person said they were a victim of domestic violence, to bifurcate the lease where they actually kicked out the offender and kept the, in most cases, the woman and the kids in the household. So there wasn't a major disruption. And also, it enabled, like, if someone was applying for housing, they were coming from a domestic violence situation, and they said, yeah, I have bad credit, or I wish that you don't contact my prior landlord or management company or mortgage, because I don't want my abusive husband or person to know where, what I'm doing. And it gave that protection.
And Randy, let's get some comment. You have raised a lot of issues here. Who'd like to pick it up?
Susan? And Randy brings terrific points to the discussion. Yes, the Violence Against Women Act, and as revised and reinstituted in 2013, does offer those kind of protections, because those were the realities of women who were leaving relationships, maybe not having the resources to return so they would go into supported housing situations, either as a transition or as a long-term place of residence. And I want to also, while we're kind of on that, again, you were talking about myths before, mm-hmm. and I think one of the myths to bust here is that all women who are leaving relationships are living in financially challenged areas. And like I said before, I mean, we get calls from every single zip code. So yeah. It's a myth that there is certainly a connection, but there is a myth that all women are just in a certain area and have certain profile or characteristics. It can happen to anyone, anywhere, anytime.
Go ahead.
Oh, and in regard to Randy, I think was the caller's name.
Yes.
One of the things I think he's also referring to, or is definitely connected, are nuisance property laws. And that's something that St. Louis has really been looking at and looking at very carefully. And it's been brought to attention over the last couple of years, and how those actually affect victims. And I think that's part of what he was referencing.
We have some emails and tweets I'd like to get to. Our production staff gives me this. A recent story on NPR was about a young male college student at the University of Massachusetts, kicked out for sexual assault, but is now himself suing the university for denying him equal protection under Title IX. One of the points is that he claims the university is overcompensating because it was under the Title IX investigation. It also said that universities aren't equipped to deal with sexual assault and that law enforcement should handle it.
Well, and I think that goes into play again to what we were talking about earlier about having trained investigators handle the sexual assault investigations, as opposed to student boards or student conduct boards, or and that being passed on to staff, the dean's office, these decisions being made by potentially individuals who do not have investigational training, do not know how to question victims or perpetrators for that matter. It's a disaster waiting to, if you don't have educated, experienced individuals responsible for the investigations of these sexual assaults on campus, it's, in my personal opinion, it's a disaster waiting to happen, because you've got trauma to the victim, you've got ineffective investigation, and basically you've got re-traumatizing the victim just going through the process alone.
It wasn't too many years ago where law enforcement was widely criticized because officers would come into a domestic violence situation and would automatically, well, again, I'm generalizing, but to a very large degree, side with the male, the abuser in the particular case, because the cop was being told by the abuser that she deserved it. She nagged me. She whatever. She'd find some reason. Is that changing?
Oh, absolutely. I think law enforcement, the culture within law enforcement is changing with that regard. And that comes with education. That comes with awareness. That certainly is a different case today.
But it was the case at one time, in a very general way.
Mm-hmm. In regard to sexual assault, the changes I've seen over the 20 years that I've been doing this are drastic as far as improvement in sexual assault response to law enforcement. Obviously, there's always areas we need to work and areas we need to focus. But in St. Louis, I can tell you that we have a very close working relationship with the St. Louis City Police Department, particularly their Sex Crimes Family Violence Unit. And then in St. Louis County, we work really closely with their Special Investigations Unit, which focusing on domestic sex trafficking victims.
We have an email here. It says, I work with young people in our community, and I wonder if your guests have any tips on starting conversations with young men about violence, perhaps using the NFL experience or publicity as a jumping-off place.
Right. One of our programs is called Guys Group, and that's the very thing that we do. We help the young men kind of identify for themselves what their own impressions of relationships are, what their own impressions of how do you interact and what is respect for women and girls, what is self-respect, what is healthy masculinity. Is it healthy masculinity to try to dominate someone, or is it really healthy masculinity to see someone as equal and to see their role in being really models of for their peers for preventing and ending violence? So one thing, you can reach out to Safe Connections, and we have all sorts of materials on our website, and reaching out to our staff would be probably my best answer in terms of getting to the experts.
I think that it's extremely important in regards to sexual assault to integrate bystander intervention, but bringing males in as allies, I think, is the important thing. When a lot of conversations around sexual violence and abuse really focus on males as perpetrators and warning them what they shouldn't do or this will happen to you, as opposed to seeing them what they truly are, which again are fathers, brothers, husbands, grandfathers. They're our allies as a culture. That's our norm. So I think it's important just to keep that conversation going that men are allies in this, not perpetrators to be trained not to perpetrate against people.
Because this is not a women's issue. This is not a girl's issue. This is a societal issue. It needs to be relevant and appreciated by everyone. So everyone can be part of that solution, and particularly boys and men, as they can be leaders and role models of their peers.
How does the media play into this, the media's role in dealing with these kinds of issues? I'm talking about sitcoms, and I'm talking about dramas, and I'm talking about the news media.
Well, again, in our teen programming, we talk about culture, counterculture. What are the messages that young people are getting today from media, from song lyrics, from kind of you name it, and exploring those, and then helping the young people develop their own counter messages to that? Because if they develop their own counter messages, then they buy in. They're part of that process, so they're not being told something. They're figuring that out in a guided, facilitated way. So media plays a large role, and so we recognize that.
And I think oftentimes objectifying particularly women has become almost a norm in a lot of media. It's unfortunate, and it's like a constant conversation that we have to have. Also with victim blaming, I think that's extremely important in regard to sexual assault. One of the things we have to talk through with victims is one of the most common responses for a victim of rape to have is to freeze or to be terrified or not necessarily respond in the way that you see in media. Most of the time when you see a sexual assault portrayed in media, it's a stranger jumping out of the bushes, where we know most rapes and sexual assaults are someone that's known to the victim and someone the victim trusts to be around them.
Well, we have limited time left, but I thought what you were going to say is the observation many times that the victim is discounted because, quote, looked the way she was dressed. She brought it on herself.
Which I can tell you from years of seeing victims right after rape or sexual assault is completely absurd. They are people who are come from every different background, every different zip code, and are dressed just like you and I are today. It's just a ridiculous notion that I think is perpetrated by myths. And
a minute and a half left. I'll start with you on this, Susan Kidder. If someone is listening right now and going through the kinds of things we're talking about, what's your best advice to them? What should they do right now?
Call our crisis helpline. And that number is 314-531-2003. Or go to our website. And we can help them in navigating resources, perhaps getting connected with Safe Connections. But know that you're not alone. And know that you are not to blame.
Cindy Millott?
If you have just been raped or sexually assaulted, it's important to go to the emergency department, local emergency department. There will be a YWCA sexual assault response team advocate that will meet you there and will be there with you to provide information, resources, and support that you might need. You have options. You don't necessarily have to report to law enforcement. You can go to the hospital emergency department, have evidence collection done, and make a decision once you get to the hospital. Obviously, we encourage everyone to contact law enforcement, but some people just aren't ready to do that. So you can just go to your emergency department. If it's something that's happened some time ago, contact our office at 726-6665 or our crisis line, which we share in part with Safe Connections, which is 531-RAPE.
Time is just about up. We'll have all of these numbers and information on our website. Very quickly, just in a word, are there programs that you're associated with for abusers? Very quickly.
There are programs in St. Louis. Raven is one program that stands out. There's additional. I think Provident also had a program in place.
Okay. Right. It's important to get to them as well. And if any are listening, check out our website. I want to thank you both so much, Susan Kidder and Cindy Malott, for being with us. A fast hour. Appreciate you being with us. Thank you.
Join
Jim Kircher tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with Christine Brewer and Peter Martin about arts and faith, St. Louis's 9/11 commemoration and music. He'll also take a look at the plein air painting event in Louisiana, Missouri, and this year's Lou Fest. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk to St. Louis Zoo President Jeffrey Bonner. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Erica Smith, Aaron Dorr, Amanda Huntingford, Bridget Dougherty, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. The program is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.